The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning, and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning, thanks to the magic of the internet and Zoom and our wonderful tech team, we are as close as your home. We're a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. I'm Preston Lutwiler, President of the Board of Trustees, and I want to personally welcome you this morning. Whoever you are on your life journey, wherever you are on your life journey, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, whomever you love, whatever your gender identity or expression, we welcome you into our ever-expanding circle of compassion and caring. If you're visiting us today, you'll notice in the Zoom chat a link to our virtual visitor card. This is a way for you to connect with us and us with you, so please fill it out at any time during the service. The Soul Matters theme for February is widening the circle, and February is Black History Month. Our talk today by Gary Burton is about Thomas Paine and slavery. I'm relieved to hear from Gary that Thomas Paine, the namesake of our fellowship, was not indifferent to slavery, but rather was ardently opposed. Unlike many of our nation's founding fathers, Paine felt that freedom should apply to all men and women. There is some angst today among Unitarian Universalists about whether we collectively and individually are doing enough to push back against racism in our country and in our communities. I would suggest that the very least we can do is hold up UU's Who Stood Up for Thomas Paine's Vision of Freedom. One such UU hero is James Joseph Reeb. Reeb was a UU minister and member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1965. In March of that year, he went to Selma to join the Selma to Montgomery marches protesting for African-American voting rights following the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson in Marion, Alabama, by a law enforcement officer. After eating dinner at an integrated restaurant on March 9th, Reeb and two other Unitarian ministers, Reverend Clark Olson and Reverend Orloff Miller, were attacked by white men with clubs. Reeb was badly injured and taken to Birmingham Hospital in critical condition, where he went into a coma and died 2 days later. There had been little written in the news about the killing of Jimmie Lee Jackson, but Reeb's death resulted in a national outcry. Tens of thousands held vigils in his honor. On March 15th, President Lyndon B. Johnson invoked Reeb's memory when he delivered a draft of the Voting Rights Act to Congress. The same day, King eulogized Reeb at a ceremony at Brown's Chapel in Selma, saying, "James Reeb symbolizes the forces of goodwill in our nation. He demonstrated the conscience of the nation. He was an attorney for the defense of the innocent in the court of world opinion. He was a witness to the truth that men of different races and classes might live, eat, and work together as brothers." And now Lorraine Lee will light the chalice with words from Sarah Eileen Lawal.
Good morning, everyone. A piece written by Sarah Lawal called Out of the Flames. Out of the flames of fear, we rise with courage of our deepest convictions to stand for justice, inclusion, and peace. Out of the flames of scrutiny, we rise to proclaim our faith with hope to heal a fractured and hurting world. Out of the flames of doubt, we rise to embrace the mystery, wonder, and awe of all there is and all that is yet to be. Out of the flames of hate, we rise with the force of love, love that celebrates our shared humanity. Out of the flames, we rise. And now, Preston, I believe you're going to light the chalice.
And the chalice is lit.
Thank you.
I'll move it to the background.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us, and with all the people,
with all the people of the world. And now we will have our gathering song, hymn number 188, Come, Come, Whoever You Are, performed by the Church of the Larger Fellowship in Providence, Rhode Island. Lyrics will be on the video.
This is one that you know. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of the evening, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again, come. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of the evening, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again, come. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer,
Gary Burton spoke to us via Zoom on July 4th, 2021 on Thomas Paine and justice. Gary is current president of the Thomas Paine National Historical Association and a member of the Thomas Paine Memorial Association. He is also associate editor of the Collected Works of Thomas Paine Project. Gary was one of the featured speakers at the Thomas Paine birthday event held on Zoom just last Saturday. The event was attended by hundreds of people from all over the country, all over the world via Zoom. And we're pleased to have Gary speak to us today live via Zoom from his home in New Rochelle, New York.
It's a key issue because of the legacy of many of the founders is mixed at best, and Jefferson included. Paine and Jefferson were very close, and Paine's last work that he wrote on his deathbed, with the help of his attendant who did the writing, was the last thing he wrote, and it was to Jefferson. It was a letter. He tried to disguise his identity as having this other person write it, and he also pretended to be an actual slave. He had to channel his emotion. Let me give some context, both currently and also historically. Currently, there's a number of conservative historians who attack Paine constantly in all their works. There's a guy who just wrote a book called J.C. D. Clark, huge book about Paine. And he said about Paine and slavery, quote, this is his quote, on neither side of the Atlantic did Paine lend his name to the cause of abolition. That's not true. Paine wrote that, Paine wrote constantly for 50 years. And over 90% of everything he wrote anonymously. We are able to uncover this. That's why we're doing a collected works project. And we've more than doubled his works. And amongst them are some abolitionist writing. He worked in the background. All his friends were abolitionists. So I want to put that in context currently. There's another writer today, a historian in Virginia, James Lynch, who attacked Paine that he never opposed slavery, which is wrong. And he also, the one thing that we do have that he signed his name to was a letter to Benjamin Rush. Get to it. He wrote a letter to Benjamin Rush when he went back to Europe in 1789. And he told Rush, quote, I wish most anxiously to see my much loved America. It is the country from whence all reformation must originally spring. I despair of seeing an abolition of the infernal traffic in Negroes. We must push that matter further on your side of the water. I wish that a few well-instructed could be sent among their brethren in bondage, for until they are enabled to take their own part, nothing will be done. Now, Lynch attacked that statement, saying Paine was washing his hands of the abolitionist movement. In fact, that is exactly the political outlook of Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth. They said the same thing. They must free themselves. So Paine was 50 years ahead of them. Let me refer to a book written a long time ago by Moore called The Life and Death of Lord Edward Fitzgerald. Edward Fitzgerald spent time with Paine in Paris in 1792. And in this book, there's a letter that Fitzgerald wrote to his mother. And it goes like this. I lodge with my friend Paine. We breakfast, dine, and sup together. The more I see his interior, the more I like and respect him. I cannot express how kind he is to me. There is a simplicity of manner, a goodness of heart, and a strength of mind in him that I never knew a man before possess. Then he goes on to say, Dr. Walker was a great enemy to slavery under all its forms. He, one day, inquired of Thomas Paine how it was to be accounted for that he had not taken up the pen to advocate the cause of the blacks. The answer offers as great a testimony to his judgment as it does honor to his feelings. An unfitter person for such a work, this is Paine speaking now, quote, an unfitter person for such a work could hardly be found. The cause would have suffered in my hands. I could not have treated it with any chance of success, for I could never think of their condition but with feelings of indignation. Those feelings of indignation erupted in his final work in a letter to Jefferson. Just a couple of other points on things that we're uncovering on Paine and slavery. In 1792, there was a pamphlet in London, England called Old Truths and Established Facts. It was a pamphlet spread all over London in the agitation to pass the Slave Trade Act, where Britain finally outlawed slave trade. Didn't stop, their ships were still doing it, but officially it became illegal. That pamphlet was written along with Joseph Priestley, who was a close comrade of Paine, and a man named Clarkson, who was an abolitionist in England. They wrote this pamphlet, Old Truths and Established Facts, and it spread all around England and helped pass that act. When Franklin returned to America in 1782, Paine joined with him in the first abolitionist society in Philadelphia, and he remained a member. He praised work of other abolitionists and other correspondents. So there is a context to this. One of the key pieces, context of this, which I have lost. Here it is. Right after he wrote Common Sense in January of 1776, he wrote an article denouncing two men in England, John Wesley and Samuel Johnson, both famous people. And he wrote a public article that spread around London. And there's a paragraph in this where he is denouncing slaveries of all kinds. And then he finally got to the actual slavery of Africans. And the quote from this article by Paine goes like this: "Subjecting Negroes to slavery is against the law of reason, the law of nature, the law of nations, the law of God, and the laws of England." There's no doubt that Paine was an ardent abolitionist. Now let me put into context a little the letter that he wrote to Jefferson. It's very complex. It's over 5,000 words. It's 20 some pages. If anybody's going to be interested in reading the entire text, we had to change the spelling of the letter because he was dictating it to a woman whose native language was French, and she was not well-versed in the English language. And we believe that's why most of the common words are misspelled consistently throughout. Like which is spelled W-I-C-H instead of W-H-I-C-H, things like that. She was phonetically writing down what he was saying. He was bedridden at that time. This is November 30th, 1808. He would die in June of the following year, but basically he stopped functioning soon after this letter was completed. But you can tell his brain was extremely acute, as right up to the end. I want to read two paragraphs to this. It's not really suitable for a morning religious service of any kind, but we're dealing with slavery. And this is the most powerfully written article against slavery that ever existed. And it was lost to our history until recently. A few decades ago, someone discovered this in the Jefferson collection. And there was a call for people to find out who wrote this letter. Nobody could figure it out until we came along with our text analysis of computer software, and as well as the context and the references in the letter. Things like you'll hear him reference the 30th of November, 1781, as a day that reparation should start for all freed slaves. that's a significant date for Thomas Paine, not the year, well, both separately, the year and the date. November 30th is when he landed in America, but it was in 1774. 1781 is when, November 71 was when Jefferson's Notes to Virginia was released, which had a segment in there declaring that the immorality of slavery, but he never acted on it. So that fixated in Paine's mind, and he wanted reparations back to that date, November 30th, 81. I will read two short paragraphs. Again, it's 5,000 words, so I can't read much more in my time, but I've made this available to Preston, and he'll be gladly send it to anybody who requests it, I believe. He'll send out a copy of it. Note that it is spelling corrected. The original doesn't look like this. If you want the original of this letter, it's in the Jefferson Papers digitally. You can find it. Just type in the date, November 30th, 1808, and you'll see it. It's very difficult to read. It's handwritten, very old, and it's all misspelled, so it's hard to make out all the words. All right, the first paragraph, a little more context to this letter. He starts off with denouncing a man named William Duane. He was the editor of the Aurora in Philadelphia, which was the paper of Jefferson, supporting Jefferson's administration. Paine had a lot of run-ins with Duane. Duane had an article in the paper declaring how America is so advanced. We're very so educated that we can lead the world. And Paine went nuts on him for the first few paragraphs. He said, you've got 2 million people in slavery. What is there to boast about, basically? And he went into him quite deeply. So the heart of this letter, I'll read in two paragraphs. The first one right in the center of the whole work. And this is Paine. "But we have not lost all hopes. Remember, he's speaking as a slave. We can't yet believe, sir, that you have become so depraved," he's writing to Jefferson now, "so depraved as to be in love with slavery, or have done reflecting upon the wrath of a just God, or that his justice cannot sleep forever. Yet there appears to me something in your administration, sir, very mysterious, what your reasons can be for keeping open that execrable market where man shall be bought and sold, which you wrote so warmly against in the year 76 and condemned as a mark of disgrace, of the deepest dye in the Christian King of Great Britain, I cannot conceive. Is a crime of this execrable nature any more criminal in the Christian crown of Britain than in the Christian executive of America? If not, what are your reasons, sir, for suffering us since the 30th of November 81 to be trodden underfoot and abused in such an inhuman and brutal manner? Are not our rights as well secured to us by every law of nature's God as any man's in the universe? We think so. Therefore, sir, we consider ourselves entitled to our yearly wages from that very hour, and no man in the government except a tyrant can dispute our demand a single moment. And you may depend on this, sir, that we shall never be reconciled to this government till we get it and our freedom with it. I think, sir, you can't do yourself and your country a greater honor, nor your unfortunate countrymen a greater piece of justice and mercy than by freeing your slaves and paying them their yearly wages from 81 to this day. And then if any slaveholder in America shall hear after refuse of or neglect so to do, let him or them be made an example of and their heads be hung in gibbets for an everlasting monument and a terror to tyrants and evildoers. Oh, Thomas, you have had a long nap and spent a great number of years in ease and plenty upon our hard-earned property, while we have been in the meantime smarting under the cowhide and sweating in the fields to raise provision to nurse tyrants to cut your throat and penetrate our own bonds. That was the more tame type of paragraph. He gets into detail on the brutal existence of a female slave. And I'm not going to read that here. He sums up this letter, his final paragraph, like this. "Oh, rouse up the brave sons of 76 and the children of those heroes who bleed and died to free their country from foreign foes and from bondage, that we and our children might live free from foreign as well as domestic tyrants. Don't let their labors be lost. Don't let so much blood be spilt in vain and so much treasure be bartered for a whistle. For Spanish folly or for British knavery and pride, oh, rouse quickly and snatch your weapons and unite your strength and let us banish all tyrant, tyranny, and oppression from North America. And let us who survive the fatal shock form but one society, one great family. And since human nature has but one constitution, let there in future, at least in America, exist but one law, that of nature, but one code, that of reason, but one throne, that of justice, and but one altar, that of union. Then might the sons and daughters of America set aside their vines and fruit trees and enjoy the fruits of their labor and the friendship of the whole human family. Then might they sit down in the joy of their hearts and sing with the birds in the following beautiful lines." He goes into a poem at that point from another author. So I advise everyone to read this letter. It's very powerful. It changes the it changes the historiography on pain a great deal, makes some of these conservative historians look like fools. And there is an article being printed this year on the proof of why this is Thomas Paine, very thorough proof. It's being printed by Cornell University Press. It's not out yet, but it's no doubt that this is Thomas Paine. So I look forward to any discussion afterwards. I will hang around as long as people want to talk, and I can talk about the proof. I can talk about more of the context of this letter and the politics. But I think I have used enough of my time. Preston, back to you.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you. Thank you very much. And it has been troubling as I have learned more and more about Thomas Paine, and I am a great supporter of Paine and admirer of Paine. And to hear historians say that he didn't write anything or didn't say anything or didn't even have an opinion on slavery is troubling and inconsistent with everything else that I know about the man. And I appreciate your organization's delving into the history to bring us the true story of what Thomas Paine's thinking was and what he did in the service of the abolition movement. Now we've come to the portion of the service that we call Matters of the Heart, where we hear from those of you who may wish to speak. And as you gather your thoughts, please listen to a musical interlude composed and performed by Isaac Strader, after which John Sayer will instruct you on how to raise your hand if you would like to speak. We'll wrap up with hymn number 123, Spirit of Life, by Carolyn McDade, performed by the First Parish Brewster Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Gary has told us that there are lazy historians who claim that Paine didn't write much about slavery and therefore was indifferent to the institution, and maybe, like Jefferson and Washington, didn't think freedom should be extended to all men and women. I want to thank Gary for setting the record straight. And remember James Reeb, of whom I spoke earlier in the program, in the service. Three of his murderers were tried and acquitted by an all-white jury. A fourth assailant fled to Mississippi, and no effort was made to capture him and bring him back to Alabama. Reeb's murder remains officially unsolved, but it was the subject of a documentary podcast, White Lies, produced by investigative journalists from NPR and released in May and June of 2019. It's definitely worth a listen, and I will send out the link to the podcast series later after this service. Now Lorraine will extinguish the chalice with words from Reverend Audette Fulbright Folsom.
Sorry, I forgot to unmute myself. Let me start over. This is from a piece written titled, "We Are Not Done." Do not think we are finished. Oh no, we will never be finished. Never just done. Until the light of justice is lit behind every eye. We have come to take back the world that is the inheritance of better children, better lovers, better days. We extinguish this chalice, but not the light of hope, kindness, and justice that we will carry with us into the widening circle of our world.
Now we will have our closing song, hymn number 121, "We'll Build a Land." The words are by Barbara Zanotti, music by Carolyn McDade. This version is my favorite, and it has some new words added by the performers Mo Mack and John and Cynthia Bowling.
Captives go free, where the oil of gladness dissolves all mourning. We'll build a promised land that can be. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace. Where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever flowing stream. Build a land where we bring the good tidings to all the afflicted and all those who mourn, and we'll give them garlands instead of ashes. We'll build a land where peace is born. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace, where justice shall roll. Shall roll down like waters, and peace like an air.